tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 436 of the Toonami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Hello.
So we'll go on to the news right away, and what we sort of predicted last week turned out to be true. We are not going to stop airing Blue Exorcist after the end of this arc. We're heading straight into the next arc, which is called the Shimane Illuminati Saga, which is quite a mouthful.
Yeah, and like I said last week, there's like 7 years of time between the air dates of season two and season three. So it'll be kind of interesting to see that jump from 1 week to the next here. But it's kind of cool that we're not going to, you know, we're going to keep going. And I know some people in the thread have said some of the later seasons get pretty cool. So
that's good.
Is there a big change in production crew between these seasons? Like, is it same studio, same directors? Like, is there a lot of turnover in staff, or do we not know?
I don't know. I'm not even sure who the studio is. Is it? I don't even know.
All right. Well, we'll be curious to see, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's A1 Pictures. Okay. So.
Yeah, when they moved from the first season to the second season, which was a long jump, the show looked the same.
Yeah.
So if they could do it again after another 7 year jump, I'll be impressed.
Yeah, more than a decade between season one and season three.
And one other schedule change, this again happens at the same time the new arc starts airing on the 23rd, is that we are going to lose the last half hour of the block. So Naruto is going to leave.
I'm guessing that they only had like rights to like the first season or whatever of Sailor Moon and Naruto, and for the Toonami Rewind on Fridays, and then Toonami Rewind ended. They still had rights for a bit, so they just slapped them onto the end of the block. But then the rights expire, and they're done.
Yeah,
that was my same train of thought as well.
Makes sense. All right, that's all I had for news. Unless you guys know of anything else.
A small bit of news today, the dub for Demon Slayer movie one, Infinity Castle, or whatever that trilogy is called, has Channing Tatum.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
As somebody. I don't know the character. But
I think he heard was a minor character or something, but.
You go, sure, why not?
I guess the hope is that that will eventually be broken up into a TV season and that will eventually make its way on Toonami in like a year or two, I guess.
Well, there's going to be three movies, right? So I wonder if they're just going to wait for all the movies to be done and then do like a season of that. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, that's we'll have to wait and see. I know that Chainsaw Man is going the same route again with having a movie instead of another season. So we'll see if they do anything once it's time for that show to start back up again.
When you have that box office money, you can get the box office money and then break it up into seasons and get the TV licensing money, double it up.
Yeah, the movie's been doing really well for Demon Slayer and a lot of other series, so I think it's clear a lot of other IPs want to get in the same dosh, so to speak.
Yeah,
flux on them.
Pretty much. I think I kind of see it too as like a way of being more smart with your money. I don't like it. I'd rather TV shows, but I get it. All right. Well, let's go on to the block then, and we will begin with Daima. Dragon Ball Daima, Episode 8, Tamagami. So this episode was basically the first part was mostly all about the fight with Goku and the Tamagami number 3. Quick rundown of the episode here like we did last week, and so we can have more discussion and then move on. Goku fights the Tamagami. We get a Kamehameha which is, I think, the first time we've seen that in this series. The Tamagami also has energy blasts as well. But he defeats the Tamagami, but that isn't the final battle. The true final battle turns out to be a battle of balls and cups, where Goku has to guess where the Dragon Ball is. Kind of a neat scene where, I mean, it was pretty obvious what was going to happen, but like it ends up being like it wasn't even under the cups, and he saw through it, and he got the Dragon Ball.
So this is just a small thing, but like I wonder what it feels like when you are Stephanie Nadolny, the voice actress for Goku, who hasn't voiced him since like Dragon Ball, you know, 20 whatever years ago, whenever that was, and like getting the dude a Kamehameha again. Yeah. I bet that's a weird feeling.
I mean, that's cool.
I mean, for like putting on an old pair of shoes or something, that's a nostalgic feeling.
Yeah.
After the battle, or whatever, the final battle, quote-unquote, Glorio does call Dr. Arinsu and gives her an update on that they've got the Dragon Ball. And she kind of alludes that this is all part of her master plan. He calls her Lady Arinsu, too, which I think is interesting, because it kind of makes it sound like he's giving her like a renowned name rather than just Dr. Arinsu.
Well, I bet in Japanese he says Arinsu-sama or something like that.
Could be. But either way, it's like a, you know, it's more than just like a late or like a, I don't know, it just sort of, it makes me feel like it means something that he calls her that. Maybe not.
And I think he's just being respectful. I mean, I know Okay. Technically Glins aren't supposed to be gendered, but like they very obviously have, you know, sexual characteristics. So
oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think he's just being respectful.
What I'm saying is Glorio doesn't strike me as the type of person to be respectful. And for him to do that here. Old time. Just, I don't know. He comes off very gruff a lot of times. So him to be like very formal to her just seems like, oh, that's an unusual side of him we don't normally see. Anyway, after the commercial break, Goma and his Glind assistant, name I don't remember, starts with a D.
Degasu. Supreme Kai's brother. Yeah, Degasu.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Supreme Kai's brother. Anyway, they're kind of looking at some stuff, and they realize, watching the old Dragon Ball Z tapes, that turns out Dr. Arinsu was there at the Battle of Buu.
Yeah, she was always there, just off screen. That's definitely not a retcon. She was just always there off screen.
Yeah. I don't mind this kind of like thing in stories in general. Like, it's fine. I think if it doesn't break the canon, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I don't think most people have an issue with it.
Yeah.
It's a little bit silly it doesn't bother me too much. It's just admittedly a little silly. Like, I was there the whole time, just off screen. You didn't see me. Yeah. And obviously this sort of retcon technique has been used many times where like I was actually at this other event that you knew a long time ago. So
yeah, whatever. The reason it works here, I think, is because she didn't interfere with anything. She just picked up a piece of Boo and left. So it's like she didn't have any impact on the events that happened. But yeah, that was her whole thing. She went to go steal a piece of Boo. And then she meets up now in present day with this witch named Marba, who apparently is the person who created Majin Buu. Now, back in the original series, and they talk about this in the episode, that they thought it was that other guy.
Bibbidi.
But turns out Bibbidi had gotten this Marba to make it, and Bibbidi just took the credit for it. This Marba is really the person who creates Majin Buu, and she's creating a new Majin that's going to be Arinsu's, like, part of her plan.
And basically the whole idea is Majin Buu was uncontrollable. This one's going to be controllable, presumably. That's the whole right. Difference.
Yeah, Majin Buu is too powerful for his own good, basically.
Yeah. So yeah, that, and she kind of like, you know, they start to work on that, and Arinsu just sort of lays it all out here on the table that her plan is that she wants to become the new Supreme Demon King. She's going to overthrow Goma. And even this Marba is like, don't underestimate Goma. He's super powerful. And then she's like, yeah, well, I've got this and I'm going to have the Dragon Balls. So she's got a plan to basically become the new king or queen, I guess. And that was the end of the episode.
There was a little bit with Bulma and Vegeta and that group.
Yeah.
They basically, they get a call from Ponzi's dad, that guy, king of some country, right? Basically saying, you know, Goku beat the Tamagame and got a Dragon Ball. And then there's a little bit where that's where they learn that there's Dragon Balls there. And there's a little moment with Vegeta and he's like, hey, you, does the Demon Realm also have Dragon Balls? And kind of goofy where he's like, I don't respond to people giving me orders.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically they're kind of learning some of the lore or like some of the stuff that's happened before they encounter the rest of the cast. Yeah, it was really more of
it's more of a scene just to make sure that they're caught up on the plot so right. that when they get there, they're going to be all caught up on what's going on. I mean, it was kind of fun to see like Vegeta, you know, get all angry, but then get shut down by that guy and then have to ask politely and struggle.
Yeah, Principal Saiyan has fallen on hard times.
All right, Crocodile, anything else you think about this episode?
Well, I think it just goes to show you the quality of production, because we skimmed over the fight pretty quickly, but it was like a movie tier quality fight. The animation, the choreography, the cinematography, it was just, it didn't last long, but it didn't need to last long. It was a tour de force. It got the point across. There was a good back and forth between Goku and Tamagami number one, and it was just a sight to behold. It was splendid. And even the little bit at the end of the cups and whatnot, classic Toriyama humor, but it was nice. It was cute. I thought it was a little cool, refreshing ending to the whole affair. But yeah, a wonderful encounter. And this is, of course, there are two more Tamagami. So like, I wonder how that'll go, but I thought it was pretty excellent. And thought so the first time I saw it, think so again. And I'm pretty sure everyone who watched it this for the first time, I'm sure, thoroughly enjoyed it if you're one who enjoys Dragon Ball at all.
Yeah, I thought that the performance of the voice actress of Goku during that scene was really good, where Goku was like, especially the part where like he's like, which one is it under? And he's like, it's not under any of them. It's over there. You know, and just the way she said it, had him say it, it was just like, I don't know, it was just really good. I kind of like, I mean, this is silly, but I kind of like this young Goku voice. I don't want to say I like it more than adult Goku, but like I like it a lot. Like I think it's just, I don't know, something nice about it.
Well, I've actually liked this voice. I know I'm not the only one with this opinion. I believe Stephanie Nadolny also voiced Gohan in the original Dragon Ball Z. And then when they like Funimation like redubbed it, and for Kai, they did Colleen Klinkenbeard. And I know I thought that was actually a step down. Colleen's great, but I never thought she was a great Gohan. Mm. And so like I've always liked her voice as either young Goku or like Gohan when she had the chance to be Gohan. So I've always liked her voice in this kind of role. So.
I think she does a good job of capturing like this was Kid Goku, but he's still like has the mannerisms of an adult, because like obviously Goku's even as adults kind of a goofy character, goofy kind of guy, but like even that kind of bit you mentioned about how she described like I know what a Dragon Ball is, that's a very like the way she presented herself was very much like adult Goku would, not like the Goku of old Dragon Ball, which I think obviously makes sense because this is adult Goku in a kid's body. So like she's straddling that line of like giving the kid performance but with like the connotation or the not the weight, let's not, I mean, that's maybe not the right word, but kind of like the intonation of an adult still, if that makes any sense. She's straddling that line very well.
Do you have any thoughts about this episode, Seda, that you wanted to share? Any scenes or moments you thought were really good?
The only thing I can think of that hasn't been said was I like the Tamagame's attitude after he lost. This isn't what he said verbatim, but it was something along the lines or in the tone of like, wow, nice fight, little dude. Good job. I respect you. Here you go. That was it. Mm-hmm. Like he was pretty happy to like, he wasn't like a sour loser or whatever. He's just like, wow, you beat me. Good job.
Yeah. And I agree with what Crocodile said. I mean, I didn't, again, I'm trying to keep these rundowns brief, but yeah, the battle was really quite a looker. I mean, it was just really well done. And it's more than just the animation. I think they really plan out how the battle is going to work. And so you get to see all kinds of great moves being used and if punches have weight and things like that. And of course, you know, having it start out kind of small and then Goku powering up and becoming Super Saiyan and was really great.
Like, for example, there's one scene in the battle, just like a battle scene before he turns Super Saiyan, where he's like dodging energy blasts from the Tamagami and he like kind of does like a wall run on like the ruins that are there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of using the environment and the way that the environment and he's animated running along it, that choreography, you know, it was planned out pretty well. So.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to say about this episode is I really like that we're learning about like what the deal is with Arensu and like what's going on there. I get the impression that Dr. Arensu isn't the big bad of this show. I think it really is Goma, but like, I like that she could potentially be like, you know, a main villain or something. And I don't know. I just think it's interesting. We don't usually get these Glynn type characters in that kind of way that I remember. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Most Dragon Ball villains are like, I am super powerful and strong and you have to meet a new transformation to beat me or whatever. And like, you know, I don't know if she's like the main villain, like you said, but she's more of like the scheming in the background type of antagonist. And it's curious, like where are they going to go with this? I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. And if they are making a new Boo, I don't remember ever seeing that. So maybe we'll see it. By the way, a quick question before we move on. Does Daima have more than one opening?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Just curious.
So they're not going to clue us in on what happens in the second half.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of thinking that. It's like, is there a character we haven't seen? And maybe there is, but I don't know. We'll see.
I mean, we know some mods is about to be created, so you haven't been introduced to every single character in the show, so, for example. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to Don to Don. Don to Don, episode 3. It's a granny versus granny clash. And that it is. So, quick rundown, and then I've got some thoughts. So, they called this character on the TV show Santa Dodoria. But she is a psychic who went on to a television show. And she was like trying to read minds and apparently didn't work or something like that. But we learn, of course, through the course of the episode that this is Momo's grandmother. And the episode basically starts out with her arriving back at her own temple where they run into Turbo Granny and they have a fight. Momo apologizes to her after the fight, which by the way, the grandma just wins easily. Momo apologizes to her grandma. And is really worried about the fact that, you know, Okarun was killed, might have been killed by her, but turns out that she had put Okarun into a shed or something, or like a little temple
like
in the back.
There's like a shrine in the temple.
Yeah, for some reason, if he's in there, he won't turn. So anyway, there's a lot of comedy stuff I'm skipping over here involving banter between the grandma and Momo, which is great, by the way. Just the way these two characters play off each other and the dialogue is so great. But basically, she tells them that the way to defeat Granny is you have to play a game of tag with her. You have to beat her at running and you got to get her kind of like outside her zone where she has influence, where she can be defeated. Something to that effect. And it turns out that even though she's like kind of against it, the grandma character, I got to be careful here. I'm talking about Momo's grandma, decides that she's going to train them to learn how to run. And it's not that Momo has to run. It's that Okarun has to run.
Can I interject for a moment here? Seiko. Yeah. Momo's grandmother's name is Seiko. So you can say Seiko and Turbo Granny if you want, if that helps you distinguish between the two characters. So you don't say Grandma.
Yeah, they probably said that too, and I don't remember that, but that sounds kind of familiar. Seiko. All right, after the commercial break, we come back and Okoroon's got to take a dump. He's got to go to the bathroom really, really bad, but he can't go because Momo has to keep her eyes on him. Otherwise, the possession will take over. So there's a lot of comedy revolving around that. But then Momo kind of explains to Seiko about how, you know, she has psychic powers now, and she kind of explains how she can see auras and close her eyes and kind of sense people's auras. Says that Okoroon's Turbo Granny aura is cold to the touch, sort of. But while she's looking away for a moment, Turbo Granny gets released, and she challenges Momo. Oh, it was when they go to the bathroom. So they end up having to go to the bathroom, and she just has to watch Okoroon go to the bathroom because there's no other way to do it. But while she turns her head for a moment to talk, the Turbo Granny takes over.
And it like stops time for a minute, and Seiko is not aware of this. Like,
that's true. Yeah.
And neither is Okoroon.
I don't think she stops time so much as like perception of
time. Basically, it was like a metaphysical conversation that the others couldn't hear in some regard. I don't know if it was actually stopping time or whatever.
Right, but I think like time stopping is actually like a big distinction. So that's why I kind of like, she's not stopping time. So, but
I kind of agree with Crocodile here. If I didn't know that, I would assume she had the power to stop everyone. But it sounds like it's more just in their heads, like in a moment. So I didn't know that. That's
like Okoroon and Seiko, like the Seiko lose perception of time because we're just kind of blotted out. But like time is still passing. Like they just aren't.
So they're probably talking like telepathically to each other or something in that moment, I guess. Anyway, you can see the Turbo Granny is in the bathroom. It's like fills up the whole bathroom. It's so big. So instead, her plan is, she says that she's going to challenge Momo to a fight in the tunnel. This is, of course, and then there's like a little bit where Seiko kind of explains that tunnel and says that, you know, that tunnel's been there for a long time, which we've already talked about being like, that's an actual like urban legend type thing in Japan anyway. Seiko dresses both Momo and Okoroon up in these sort of traditional priest type outfits that are supposed to ward off demons or protect them. And they get on the train and they feel really embarrassed about going there looking like that. And then we get the credits. And then after the post credits, we see that Momo ends up just taking off that outfit because she thinks it looks stupid, which seems kind of reckless to me, but I guess we'll see. That was the episode. So Sato, why don't you go ahead and start this time? What are your thoughts? Anything?
I like how Momo's apparently like philosophy in life is, what would Ken Takakura do? That's her philosophy. Cause when she's like deciding like how to help or whether to help Okoroon, like, well, if Ken was here, and remember, Ken is like this old actor,
yeah.
Right? Like, what would he do? It's kind of weird that a teenage girl is obsessed with like an actor from decades ago, but whatever. It's like, what would he do? He would help. He would be the helpful like hero. So I'm going to do what he would do. I don't know.
That'd be like a young person today, like fawning over Harrison Ford. You know what I mean? Like now, yeah. Harrison Ford's a grandpa now, but they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about the Harrison Ford from the 1980s and stuff. So
yeah. What would Harrison Ford do? Also, I really like, I actually didn't recognize the voice. I'm like, as soon as Seiko started talking, I'm like, this is a really good voice performance. Who's the voice actor? It's Kerry Washington. And she's done like a billion things. So she's Haruko. I didn't
pick up on that.
She's Saber and like a billion Western cartoons, and she's been around forever. But yeah, Kerry Washington. I think she did a really good job as Seiko.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, before you continue, I just got to quickly say, like, I love the dialogue in this show. Like the way the characters talk is so, it's kind of like Tarantino-esque kind of in a way where they're just sort of like, I don't know how to describe it. It's just so natural feeling, and like the jabs that they constantly have at each other, the way they kind of bicker and stuff. It's so fun. to just listen to. I can't describe it. It's so good. I couldn't write dialogue like that if I tried. It's so good. Anything else, Seda?
Like, not so much. It was a really entertaining episode, kind of setting up the next goal. We knew that they had to somehow take out Turbo Granny. There was a little bit of, like, kind of explanations, not deep explanations, but explanations of, like, how the, you know, how the mediums work. And the, like apparently Seiko gets her power from, like, the goddess or god of, like, the territory she's in. So she leaves it. She can't, like, that's, you know, a little bits and pieces of, like, how the spiritual and supernatural powers happen to work. I don't know if we mentioned that Seiko also does not believe in aliens, despite Momo talking about, I was on a UFO. And Seiko,
it's a running gag that they did throughout the whole episode, which is hilarious because they just, every time she's just like, aliens aren't real. Aliens aren't real. And it's like, they kept saying it over and over, even though we know it is. That's great.
I mean, Seiko and Momo had the same belief system. So she's just basically mirroring Momo, or the Momo of like two episodes ago in that sense.
True.
I have a really important question. Sorry, I'm going to change tacks here. I really apologize. How does Okaroon urinate?
Well, I'm just going to, I thought about this too, unfortunately, and I'm just assuming he just has really bad runs.
Yeah. Or there's just a hole there or something, right? So, like, your urethra obviously
looks... Don't think about it.
Okay, but I mean, sure, if you wanted to try to think about it, I assume it's just
technically, it's possible. It just has to go out a different hole. So, that's...
Well, it would just, like, it would just be a hole... Yeah, we don't need to talk about it. It's not a serious question.
I thought for a moment... I know. I thought for a moment, it's like, are they going to address this? And they don't. But when they talked about the fact that he had to take a dump, I thought, oh, well, that must be the answer. You know, it's as simple as that.
Well, no, it wouldn't reroute to his backside. It would just come out the front.
Kind of does. That's what happens with babies, actually, I think. So anyway, what was I going to say? Oh, there's like this whole theme, too, with like Seiko and like baseball. And she has like the nails and stuff. And like I wish I had written it down, but there was a really great line in the episode, too, where she has this baseball bat that she uses as part of her like exorcism practice. And there was a line towards near the end of the episode where she kind of does something where she says something is a reference to baseball. Like, I don't know if it was like hit a home run or something like that. She said something and I thought, oh, well, that's really nice.
I remember some metaphor. I don't remember what it was though.
Are you talking about when Momo and Okaroon were leaving for the boss battle? She was like wishing them luck. Was that moment or?
Something like that. She just said something. It's like she was like giving them some advice and was like, you got to knock it out of the park or something like that, where it was like a baseball reference. And I thought, oh, that's nice.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Kind of cool way to tie it into her character. Yeah. What about you, Crocodile? Thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I just think not even just the banter, but just kind of like the how to even interact physically with each other. I think Momo and Seiko kind of have a pretty fun relationship, and the way kind of Okaroon's kind of like thrown in the middle of that is works pretty well. Also kind of like, remember that whole running sequence when you're trying to get to the bathroom, kind of just comedy, but it's kind of like well executed comedy. So that was, I very much appreciated all of that. There was kind of some interesting explanations about like the power system, whatnot, kind of very reminiscent of like demon domains. You see similar power systems in other shows. My memory, it feels like, I think like part of explanation either is contradicted later or something, but my memory could be a little off on that. So let's just move that aside for now. But it was still to get some lore building for like kind of at least how the power system might work and kind of like how you have to confront the demon in the end. I felt kind of amusing how they were trying to do a training arc and Turbo Granny was like, fuck your training arcs, we're doing this now. Get over here. That was kind of funny. Like, I don't think she was being like John Savory in that sense, but I just thought it was kind of funny how she interrupted. It was a serious moment, obviously. But it was kind of funny how she just interrupted the training arc to be like, no, we're doing our battle now at this time, so get over here. I do think Momo getting rid of her like poison ward, stone petrification ward armor, so to speak, to change into her like her own fashionable outfit, because if she's gonna do the boss fight, she's gonna do it looking stylish. It's very in character for her, but also kind of hilarious in a way. So, and it's good to see that they've kept the after credits scene, because I was wondering, are they going to keep the scene? And so I was glad to see they did. So that was obviously a good kind of character moment for Ro, even though it was a bit silly. And of course, I really enjoyed the kind of moments between Okru and Momo, kind of like once she realized he was alive, and then kind of their exchanges together. They're like they're both frustrated together, but also very much care for each other. And that the sense of camaraderie is, of course, just only going to grow as the series continues. So, just lots of nice moments. And I guess to begin with, that little bit with Seiko kind of does that reading of that idol. Everyone thinks she's a fake, but lo and behold, she got everything right. It was kind of a little interesting venue into there are limits to what she can do, but she is the real deal. But I guess we kind of got that sense when we realized that ghosts and aliens do exist in this world. But it's good to have that kind of bit of I think, you know, Seiko is she's legit. She's a little weird. There are limits to what she can do, but she is legit.
Yeah, I really liked this episode. Mostly my favorite stuff, though, was the banter and the dialogue between, and the relationship stuff between Momo and her grandma. We had kind of heard about that in the past, and now we're seeing how rocky their relationship is, but at the same time, they really care about each other. I like that the whole episode that Seiko was really giving Momo a hard time, but at the same time, at the very end of the episode, she gives her a hug. And it was just like, you get like this really nice moment of you see where her heart really is. And it's really good character development for both of those characters.
She really wants her granddaughter to come back alive. It's very important.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. She plays cool a lot. She plays like she's cool and cocky, but then you can see that she really does care. Yeah, but otherwise, another fantastic episode of Donna Donna, a show that continues to make me question where it's going to go next, because I really have no idea. The show is kind of crazy kooky. I would say that, Okurun kind of takes a backseat in this episode to a certain extent. I mean, he's there and stuff happens, but it didn't feel like it was really focused too much on him. It was mostly about their relationship of Seiko and Momo. All right. Well, let's move on to Bleach. Bleach episode 11, A Thousand Year Blood War, episode 11, Everything But the Rain. And there certainly was a lot of rain in this episode. Quick rundown. Ichigo, now sent back to Earth, seeks the help. He kind of goes to his house, but then sees his dad and then runs away. He doesn't want to deal with it. So he runs he goes and stays at Miss Ikumi's place. Now, I kind of inferred this because I didn't know who she was, but I inferred from the context of the episode that this was like a character that he used to work for her.
She was introduced in the Fullbringer arc. So that was like the last canon arc in the original anime, which I guess you didn't see, right? So that's where she was.
Well, maybe from. I did. I just don't remember her.
Okay. Oh, I would also make an important distinction. Ichigo didn't go home. He was sent home, and then he ran from home because he was ashamed to see his father at that point in time. So he didn't go to his house. He was sent there by the Captain Zero guy, whose name I'm forgetting. But
good point. Yeah, because he didn't want to be there. Anyway, he hangs around with Miss Ikumi, and she kind of gives him tough love, but then also is like, hey, you can always lean on me if you need something. And, you know, he takes a shower and stuff and then leaves. And then Ichigo runs into his dad, and his dad goes into the story about where Ichigo came from and who he really is. And this is when the commercial break happens, which leads into, after they return, the flashback. We see in the flashback that Ishin, who is Ichigo's dad, went by the name Captain Shiba. And he was, of course, as we knew, a soul reaper. He had his own subordinates and stuff. While he's going around doing his stuff, we see Aizen and his minions are performing these holification experiments. I don't really know what they're doing, but maybe it's not important. They're just doing
it's a prelude to a lot of the work that they go over in the Waco Mondo arc and stuff like that.
Yeah, I figured it was stuff that we people who knew Bleach already knew. Like, it wasn't new information. Like, I didn't know that, but I assumed it was like, oh, this is stuff that's been known. But they were doing their experiments and they're creating these, like, you know, evil hollow things. We then cut to who I'm assuming is Ichigo's mom. It's this young woman named Masaki. She lives in this sort of like very, I don't know, rich, affluent family of a bunch of Quincy's. She was adopted by what's called the Ryukin family, and they're apparently trying to protect the Quincy bloodline or something. And she's, I guess,
this is Uryu's family, right?
Yes.
In the past.
Is it?
It's like the ex. So there's like two branches of the Quincy's. There's like the Yawabawa branch back in the Soul Society, and then these are like the offshoot ex Quincy's. That
I wouldn't say like I wouldn't frame it like that. Rather like there had been the genocide of Quincy's, so there aren't too many Quincy's left. So like all the Quincy's are kind of like interconnected in fashion, but like Uryu's family is kind of one of the few Quincy's that are like alive and in the world of the living, kind of on this side. Whereas a lot of the Quincy's that hang around with Uba, like they're not like they're on the other side, so to speak. So there's not like it's a little more complicated than that. There's like, but there are Quincy's and there are not too many of them left. And so that's kind of where they're all really worried about the purity of the bloodline, so to speak. So Masaki is a pure-blooded Quincy, and then Uryu's father, the white-haired man, this is obviously a younger version of him, is also pure-blooded Quincy, and they're trying to get them married together so they can have babies. And
I was going to ask that. If they were are these two supposed to be betrothed?
That was the plan, but obviously the plot of Bleach happens, so they don't get married, but that was the plan for them to get married.
Okay, I kind of thought that. I couldn't tell if it was they were like brother and sister like, even though she's adopted, or if it was like they're supposed to get together.
They're unrelated. They're Quincy sort of like related by like nth degree, but they're not so related where they're not cousin fucking, like, you know.
Okay.
That's not a concern,
I was really asking was the plan for them to get together?
Yes.
And then she bucked the plan.
Yes, yes. I also mentioned quickly that Ishin Shiba, Ichigo's father, is related to Ganryu, and that the woman with big knockers and one arm who's in charge of fireworks.
Oh yeah.
So there's a lot of like family relations kind of like being further explored in this flashback that maybe if you're not a big Bleach head, you maybe don't catch upon, but I think are worth mentioning at least briefly.
Okay. So anyway, back to the quick rundown here. We're almost done. The Captain Shiba Ishin goes to Earth, and he's trying to protect an area, and it turns out there's a black hollow attacks, and this is I'm pretty sure this is something that's happened, seen before. It's an Aizen thing, so I'm assuming, but I didn't know what it was. Just a black hollow with like a filled in heart hole and whatnot. We do see Aizen and his minions appear in the sky, and they're sort of watching to see what's going to happen as this black hollow attacks. And it's, you know, Ichin's doing okay, but it does kind of end up giving them really hard time. And then while this is going on, Masaki back at her house sort of feels his spiritual pressure, realizes someone's in danger. How do you say his name?
Uryu, his father. I think his name is Ryukin.
Ryukin. So Ryukin's like, don't go out there. They're soul leaders, you know, soul reapers. We don't want to go to soul, you know, soul reapers are the bad guys. But she goes anyway. She's like, I'm not going to live my life I can't live my life if I know I let someone die or something like that. So she goes out there. And of course, she uses her Quincy powers to save Ishin while he's laying on the ground bleeding. Of course, this is when we saw this at the very beginning of the episode, and we finally catch back up to that moment. And this is, of course, Ichigo's mother and father in the future meeting for the first time. And that's kind of where the episode ends, although there is a post-credit scene where we do see Uryu, I guess in modern time.
Yes.
And I don't even remember what happens. He's just there. He says something.
He's like in the rain, like being a big sad, He's thinking a lot. Why am I blanking that word? complicative.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time with the guy's name, so I don't blame you.
Uryu's in the rain. he's in midst of big think, and then the second command of the Quincy army. I think his letter is B, or regardless, the blonde guy is remembered him. He broke Ichigo's sword. He's second command. He shows up and he's about to confront Uryu, and they're going to have a chat.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Crocodile, why don't you go over your thoughts on this episode? Any details you think I should know about that I didn't cover that are important?
Well, I already mentioned all the family stuff. I guess I would mention that Aizen was actually got involved in fight briefly to try to he backstabbed Isshin and that's part of why Isshin was about to get killed by Hollow until Masaki jumped in. So that's a little bit about noteworthy. And there's also something else that he mentioned, just maybe a bit of a spoiler, but the confrontation between the Black Hollow and Masaki had a very specific outcome that frustrated Tosin and Gin, but Aizen was like, no, let's see it play out. And I don't want to necessarily spoil it, but let's say the manner in which the battle between the Black Hollow and Masaki went down, especially if it biting her, is going to be very important in the near future. So just mental check note of that. I won't say more about spoiling it.
Yeah, I did pick up on the whole idea that Aizen learned something valuable from that impromptu fight that they didn't plan, which is useful for him. One thing I also want to point out too, which, I mean, it goes without saying, you can just understand this. I mean, I don't remember exactly what Masaki's last name is, but I know that she's eventually going to Kurosaki, right?
Yes.
So she's the Kurosaki, which means that obviously Isshin's going to take on her name at some point.
Correct.
Because he's called Shiba at this time. So
yes, he takes my name.
I kind of was confused by that because I'm not that familiar with Isshin as a character. And I know that Isshin is Ichigo's dad. But then when they went to the flashback and they called him Shiba, I was kind of like, wait a minute, same character? It is.
The thing is that Isshin is a soul reaper, so he isn't technically alive. But Quincy's are living beings. I think that's probably maybe the part of logic
it gets
for
weird.
Why he took her last name. And they may have elaborated more.
Quick question. Who's alive?
Well, Masaki is a living being. Shiba technically is not. Nor is technically Aizen.
Okay, but
Soul
keep
Reapers
going.
Are speakers, and Masaki
keep
is
going.
Like...
No Soul Reapers are alive.
Well, what about our main cast, the main characters? Who's alive?
They're all alive.
All of the main characters are alive. Okay.
Main characters being Ichigo and... Well, Rukia is not. Renji is not alive because she's a...
Correct. Naruto's Byakuya. Ichigo is a weird mongrel chimera of a beast of a person. So
but he's alive.
But yes. Yes, he is alive. And the reasons why he is alive get why he is a living being get explained later. And how Isshin and Masaki are able to produce an offspring will get explained. But yes, technically, Masaki is living.
That's a whole other ball of wax about the fact that he's a dead guy having a kid. But here's another quick question.
It'll make sense.
This is another big Bleach question. I'm sorry, and then I'll let you talk, Seda. So we saw in the flashback when Captain Shiba was in charge, he had the big boobied Captain Woman with him.
Rangiku.
Masumoto?
No, Rangiku.
Oh, isn't her last name Masumoto? Ranguku Masumoto?
Probably.
Okay, yeah. Rangiku is Rangiku, yeah.
Okay.
Because they do age. Even though they're not alive, they do age a little bit.
But they live for a long, 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 long time.
Yeah,
right?
they age, but they live for they can live for up like a thousand, they can live for hundreds of years.
We saw young Yamamoto.
Yeah, so it's weird.
Yeah, but that's true.
They're talking a lot of living beings, but they do age, but they have lifespans of hundreds of years plus. It's weird. Whatever.
Do they die of old age? Do we know?
I think so.
Do people who live in the Soul Society have kids?
Yes.
Wow, it's so confusing. I don't understand. See,
Rukia
the Soul
didn't
Society.
Just think Rukia and Renji and the younger generation of Soul Reapers didn't just sprout from nothing. They were born, and they were born from recycled soul energy, but people still banged, and that's they still came out that way. But
it's weird. I know you're glossing over that, but that seems super important to me. Like, okay, so the Soul Reapers, are they like another race of people, or are they souls of humans who died?
They are the recycled energy like of souls from people.
What? Bleach discussion.
Yeah, so they're like souls of humans who've like gone through like a process and then be reconfigured. So they're not like, it's not like a human being just becomes a Soul Reaper, but human soul energy eventually be, you know how like we're all made of stardust, like literally, yeah. Like human beings are made of like stardust, literally. It's similar to that. Like Soul Reapers are made of human souls that have kind of like decomposed and like kind of be that resource has been repurposed. And then like Soul Reapers can become humans if that their soul energy decays. It's a cycle, basically. So people don't like necessarily reincarnate, but their energy becomes repurposed for building blocks for new quote unquote life.
But they can also create life.
Yes. And sometimes life in literal sense, sometimes life in the quotation mark sense.
All right, that's enough. Okay, Seda, what are your thoughts?
My only thought on that was, this is like, these are like long-standing Bleach discussions, because when the Soul Society was first introduced, it was sort of like referred to, not directly, but kind of like an afterlife. But then they kind of became just like its own realm of like its own rules and characters and lives in there. And it just, yeah, all these questions started to pop up about like, how do they age? Can they die? Like, or do they have children? So yeah, these are long-standing Bleach weirdness, and I kind of just gloss over it because it's like whatever.
And note, it's important to note that like these afterlives are like regional or cultural. Like the whole part of Burn the Witch is that the afterlife in England is different than afterlife in Japan, which is another whole like kind of weird thing. But
and that's Kubo's other manga, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, I forgot about that. That was like the American version.
It takes place in the UK.
Or in the UK, excuse me. Yeah, UK. It was like the UK branch.
Yes, but Birth, Burn the Witch, and Bleach are in the same universe.
See, I find that stuff fascinating. Okay. Overall thoughts on this episode, Seda?
Not really, other than that, like, these are sorts of... So, when we were watching Bleach, the original run, we ended at the... Was it the Fullbring arc? And...
Yes.
There were all these questions that had, like, started to get answered. Like... We didn't know for a while exactly what was up with Ichigo's dad. And then, like, we learn he's a Soul Reaper, and, like, we kind of, it was like piecemeal, like, learning all these little bits and pieces about, like, wait, Ichigo's dad is a Soul Reaper? How does that work? And, you know, like, who is Ichigo and whatnot? And, like, all this stuff starts to pop up, and now we're kind of finally getting answers to that. So, like, these are things that have been kind of building for a while, and we're finally kind of getting, you know, the anvil dropped in terms of here's what happened. And obviously there's still more to go through, but we'll see. And then also, like, Aizen was the big bad for a long time, and he was finally defeated, right, in the couple arcs ago, right? But he's still around. He was present briefly in the attack from the Quincy's. He's in jail. But here he is in the flashback, we're learning more about him. So it's kind of like he didn't go anywhere. He's like, he was defeated, but he's still present, and I kind of know through osmosis that he does more eventually. So,
Aizen's too cool to not be around.
Yeah, apparently. You can't get rid of him that easily. So,
literally.
Yeah, I think I'll end it the conversation on Bleach by just saying that I thought it was an okay episode. It wasn't as good as the last several episodes we've had, and I think mostly because it felt pretty predictable to a certain degree. I kind of just knew what was going to happen. I mean, maybe being a flashback kind of unfortunately just allows it to be that way, but like, I get where this is going. I don't know the details, but I get the fact that, you know, we already knew that Masaki was a Quincy. We already knew that that was Ichigo's mom, and that, you know, they're going to have to meet. The fact that we're seeing this, I guess if you're a longtime Bleach fan, is very interesting and neat. But for me, as someone who's relatively new to it, I was just like, yeah, I kind of expected this to just, you know, this is what we were going to see. So
it's playing out as expected, but I think it was nice to turn a lot of speculation to hard fact kind of thing.
There was the last thing I'll say, too, is that there was a lot of like imagery in this episode. They really try to play up this idea of like the rainfall. and the way it affects things. And there was a lot of shots where like they would like they'd be this real serious scene, and then it would just cut to shots of just rain falling, and then even moments when the rain would like freeze and then like start raining again. It's like they were really playing into the whole rain theme through the whole visual storytelling part of the episode. Okay, well, let's move on to Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist, Episode 11, Shine Bright as the Sun, the penultimate episode of this season.
So before you start, I need to head out quickly, but I just want to say two things. First of all,
go ahead.
They said the thing, Blue Exorcist, title drop, huzzah.
Yeah.
Second of all, Shimiko just pulled Izumo out of the gunk or whatever. Like, that seems like way too easy. I guess, I don't know, I like Izumo and Shiami, but they didn't really feel like got much to do here. Like, the women just kind of got side-arred here. Yeah. This is a little weird. And also, Mephisto, get off your lazy ass. That's what I need to say. All right.
Okay, cool. All
right, so I'll talk to you guys later.
Take it easy.
All right.
All right, quick rundown here. So Suguro, a.k.a. Bone, passes out. He's been keeping that barrier up for a long time, but he couldn't do it anymore, ends up passing out, and the barrier does fall away, putting everyone in danger. Meanwhile, Todo's body keeps regenerating. He's mocking Yukio for being part demon. He says he can't wait to see what's going to happen with Yukio. Just really giving him a hard time. And Yukio here is really, we're seeing a side of Yukio we don't normally see, where he's really distressed. He's really freaking out.
And Todo mentioned something about like Yukio's face. Like, I forget precisely what he says, but like, you have the face of a demon, or like, you know, showing your anger or something like that. And yeah, like Yukio is letting it get to him a little bit, where he's like, what? No, but it's true. he's doubting himself.
Yeah, he even brings up this like tenet of like, that's rule number one of being an exorcist is don't let the demon get to you. Don't let their words affect you. But it's even though he knows that and he's saying it out loud, it's working. He can't,
yes, clearly he can't
prevent it. it's really messing with him. So that's pretty much the first half of the episode. When we come back from the commercial, there's this long scene where Rin is talking to that fire demon, and I wrote down just lots of techno babble here.
Yeah, I'm assuming this ties into Japanese mythology and lore and creatures that the average Japanese viewer would have like some familiarity with, like, oh yeah, this is the, you know, some myth or story that we know, because they talk about like the origin of the Koma sword, like this fire demon and its abilities, and like you'll have this ability if you put it into the sword, and it's all said very quickly, and you call it like techno babble. And yeah, when they started blabbing like that, I just sort of assume that these are related to concepts that a Japanese person probably can grasp onto more easily than us.
That's maybe my assumption. Yeah, that might be true. I kind of just took it as being like Naruto speak, which maybe be the same thing. But you know, when Naruto would go off on their tangents about like all of their, they would just throw out all these words that I were just like, what are you talking about? I don't know what these things are. It was like that. So I kind of was like, okay, whatever, just power up already, get to it. And they do. And like Crocodile says, there's a scene where we cut over. Shimmy is worn out. She has lost her strength to the point that she can't even summon her little familiar anymore. And Izumo's yelling at her, and he's like, stop, you're going to die. And Shimmy's got too big a heart, and she's like, I'm going to save you, even though you don't want me to, and climbs up. And yeah, a little weird that she's just able to pull her out of that. I mean, it's like, okay. But yeah, saves Izumo, who's, you know, it's like, don't you know I hate you? which I think is, of course, not true. But
and then Shammy is like, I don't care. I like you.
Yeah, I don't care. I like you. I'm too good. And yeah,
I'm too.
How many times does Izumo need to be learning this lesson that it's okay for people to be nice to her?
Well, like I think I said this on the previous episode. I kind of hope. I mean, not kind of. I do hope that Izumo softens up a little bit, even though it's her personality type not to.
Right. But not yet, apparently.
Nope. Maybe next season.
Yeah. Also, that one chick hasn't shown up, which I'm guessing she's.
Oh yeah, it sounds like she has been sidelined. I mean, this is all her fault. So yeah.
I feel like this was the moment.
There's one more episode of this season, which is obviously going to be kind of like a cool down denouement type episode. And will she show up like as some sort of reconciliation or like, I'm sorry. Probably. I know she already sort of said sorry, but
she's probably going to be like seen in like a bed.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just like, my guess. It's just kind of an unfortunate character. If this is all it is, where it's like, I was tricked by a demon and I caused all this pain and that's it. Sorry.
Yeah.
I screwed up. I'm like, oh, okay.
I will say that the way this episode plays out at the very end with the credits over the story and everything, and almost a fourth of the episode is post credit content. It felt like the final episode of the season, even knowing there's one more.
Yeah.
Okay. Quick finish of the rundown here. So, Rin uses his full power to try to defeat the Impure King. And while this is happening, the evil side of Rin, the demon side, starts to take over him. He's like, ah, yes, kill, destroy everything. And he's like, no, I can do it. And he wins out. His goodness wins out. And he's able to send his blue flames everywhere. And it only attacks the miasma. And even to the point where it actually cures some people who've had afflictions. So it's a good blue flame, and Mephisto up in the sky is super excited about all this. And he even says, witness the birth of the blue exorcist. What does he say? He says the thing. And then he's like, the blue exorcist, the creature designed to kill its own kind. Now, my question to you, what does designed to kill what? Demons or humans?
Yeah, we all kind of figured that Mephisto, his position has always been weird. He's like a leader of the exorcists, and he just hangs around with people like Shura and other like exorcists, even though he is a demon. But he's like up in the air on his couch, kind of doing normal like impish scheming type stuff with playful banter and whatever. And he doesn't actually like intervene, but he sometimes does. And what's he planning? That's probably the long game. My guess, broadly, is that like he's somehow forming Rin to become like some sort of weapon to like, I don't know. This is just a shot in the dark, but like if Mephisto wants to kill another demon, maybe he can't do it himself, but maybe he can get Rin to do it for him.
Or he wants to. He wants to kill the demon, the main demon, the devil, or something. Maybe. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. But. I want to be clear that, like, in hindsight, as I was thinking about this, I think he's talking about, because he calls him the blue exorcist. So the blue being the flame, the exorcist being a human defeats demons. So I'm thinking when he says designed to kill its own kind, he's talking about a demon.
Right.
He's talking about, he's a demon designed to kill other demons. And so like you're saying, like he's creating Rin so that one day Rin can be used to fight a greater demon, some power demon. Yeah.
Yeah. That's more or less what I said. He has some ulterior motive for Rin here. He like, obviously all exorcists fight demons, but he has some plan for Rin.
And Rin's plan is to punch the shit out of Satan. Right. That's still a thing. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's not like that's a canon thing.
Yeah, it's like what happened in the last half of season one doesn't count. Forget that.
Right. But I just want to I'm asking because I want to make sure that was said before that. That was like a thing. Okay.
I think so.
Okay.
I also want to point out that Mephisto quotes Nietzsche.
Or
how you pronounce his name. He quotes, I actually pulled it up here. He who fights with monsters should be careful lest they become a monster. And if thou gaze long into an abyss, the abyss will also gaze into thee. I don't know. He just quoting German philosophers for fun. He does that.
When I heard that, I thought it was interesting that demons care about what humans think. I guess they do. I don't know. It's like, I'm so used to the trope that like a demon or some other like other life form or other higher plane of angels or something would be like, oh, well, humans are beneath us. Like you, like what they think isn't important. But here he's like quoting a famous philosopher, a human.
What's also funny is I know that Mephisto in the past has like shouted or spat random German words.
Just, he does what he does.
And like, this is a German philosopher. Like, why is he obsessed with these German?
Oh, yeah, he's maybe there's something German about him, like in his design. Even could be. Did you notice in this episode when they cut to him, like he's floating up there on his little couch or whatever? Did you notice how it had like this weird patchwork design behind him? It kind of looked like a quilt or something that was all stitched up poorly. And I'm like, well, what is that?
I think he got the top hat that's sort of similar, like kind of banner around it, maybe. I don't know.
It was weird. I just thought, like, what is, like, if he could summon a magic like sofa in the sky to sit on, why does it look so weird? Like, there's something to that, I think.
I'm looking up his character art now, and he's got like the polka dot collar or whatever. I don't know. It's kind of like it's a little bit like carnival-ish almost.
Yeah.
He would not be out of place in like the big top or whatever.
Right. And that, then that thing that was behind him in this episode kind of reminded me of that too. Like kind of carnival look. Well, like I said, we don't get the ending in this episode. Instead, we get like credits over the story. And, you know, it's just kind of a cool down bit where, yeah, everyone shows up to like see Rin. And Rin's like real happy. He's like, look, guys, I controlled the flames. I can do it now. I did it. Yay. He's real happy. And then Yukio comes up and just punches Rin in the face. And he's like, you're too reckless, I guess. And Rin's like, yeah, I know.
But then Rin also kind of says, like, he pulls out the sword and he's basically like, this is who I am. This is me. And I forget exactly what he says, but he's like, but I'm also going to need you to help. Like, not being so, you know, forget you, I'm going to do what I want. Not like that. It's like, more like, I can't control who I am. I am who I am. This is me, but I'm going to need your help. And, like, he's trying to, like, there's obviously still animosity between the two brothers. But he's kind of standing up for himself, too. So
he's becoming way more of an older brother here. And it's to the point where Yukio is becoming like this, like in this final scene, even like Yukio just has this look on his face where he's just sort of like, it's just not the Yukio we're used to seeing. Right. And it kind of makes me worry that we're not going to get the old Yukio back. I don't know. We'll see. But he was like shocked and like worried.
He's like, he was introduced in like the first season as, even though the younger brother, he was like, you know, in control, in charge, mature, straight laced in a way. But now he's obviously throughout this season kind of becoming more uncertain. He's letting a demon's words get to him. He doesn't know how to handle Rin. And we were actually wondering, is this conflict between the two brothers going to be like wrapped up in this season, or is it going to be going forward? And considering it's only one episode left, probably going forward to some degree. This kind of,
I think so too. What, I think that this,
and
is
also Yukio's, they didn't get rid of Toto yet. Toto's still around.
Yep.
They like quenched him again, but he even said, we have to get out of here before he comes back. Like, Toto is not dead. And they know that he's around. So we were also wondering, is he going to get wrapped up in the season? And answer is nope. He's still around. So
no, he even said something like he kind of alluded to his future plans, but I don't remember the details, but there was something he was talking about where he's got plans to do something. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the final battle episode. That was what this was. It was the resolution of the arc. And like you said, I'm pretty sure the next episode is just everyone leaving and saying their goodbyes and that kind of thing.
Yeah, like an epilogue of some sort.
Yeah. And I'm sure the father, like is going to make a comeback and get well. Unless they pull like a he dies in the last episode, which I don't think so, but they could do that. But I think it's more likely he's just going to be like, you know, telling Suguro to be like, you did good, my son, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get to the last episode of this week, which is One Piece. One Piece episode 739, The Strongest Creature. One of the four emperors, Kaido, King of the Beasts. Quick rundown. Kiros and Zoro have a bottle of drink together. Zoro wants to battle Kiros one day. Meanwhile, we see Chopper and Sanji are yelling at Caesar and trying to command Caesar to help some people. But Caesar doesn't want to do it. He's just walking away. Nami and Brooke and Momonosuke at the same time are being chased by these guys who are kind of dressed like barbarians.
So from my perspective here, like this is clearly, I know we've talked about this, that the next arc is, it seems like we're not there yet, but this is sort of like a prelude, like, you know, a look in.
Yeah. Oh,
here's what's happening right now. And then we'll get back to this maybe in, I don't know, 10 episodes or something.
Yeah, it's going to be like 10 or 12 episodes, but you will be there soon enough. Anyway, these people on these giant crocodile looking things are chasing those three around, giving them a hard time. And then suddenly there's a rain eruption. And we see like a kind of volcano thing go off, and there's just rain coming down everywhere. And this guy who's been chasing them with, who for some reason I didn't expect this, he has like a hillbilly kind of accent. His name is Sheep's Head, and him and Brooke have a little
kind of like
off where we see this Sheep's Head character uses some kind of power, which turned into sheep's horns.
Yeah,
what were you gonna say?
His accent is like, yeah, hillbilly. It's sort of like, so he rides like these alligator things, right? And it's kind of like, it's sort of like the Florida hillbilly specifically, like the type of person who's like, Ma, I'm going to wrestle that gator out back of the trailer or whatever.
It does come across. So that's the sort of accent
they gave him, like Florida hillbilly. I don't know if they just decided that, oh, he's a gator guy, so that's what they're going to do. I don't know.
Well, so like I said, Brooke and Sheep's Head have a clash, but Sanji kind of flies in at the last second and finishes the fight and knocks Sheep's Head down. I think it's important that Brooke kind of like, and I think Nami as well, are like, what is this guy's weird power?
Yeah.
And then
they couldn't parse it.
And then at the same time, the woman who was with this guy, her name was Jin Rummy. She tells a bunch of the other people who are clad in the same attire that are around them, says, let's get out of here. The samurai isn't here.
So I'm wondering which samurai are they looking for? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. While this has been going on, Nami, Brooke, and Momo have been like, we keep talking about like, who is that mysterious girl? There was that mysterious girl. And then we do see like a very brief shot of somebody hiding behind a tree.
Yep.
I don't know if And then the final bit of the episode. Yeah, you saw that. I'm assuming you saw more than you're saying. What did you see?
No, they showed the girl behind the tree. I don't know who it is, but I saw that. I don't know who she is.
Did you notice anything funny about her?
Her teeth or something.
Okay, I won't say anymore.
I don't remember.
Watch it again. you'll notice it right away. Anyway, mysterious girl. But then we end on the last bit of the episode, which is kind of calls back to something that happened about two or three episodes ago when Urooj was up on the Sky Island and there was some big tromping person coming towards them. Turns out it was indeed Kaido himself. He was up on this sky island called Balloon Terminal, which I think is kind of funny. It's just like a sky island and like lifted by balloons. Anyway, he's standing on the precipice of the edge of the island and he's jumping off in order to try to kill himself. But he survives. and we get this sort of like introduction to Kaido here. What are your thoughts on this? I'd be curious.
So Kaido's been talked about for a while. Like, that's basically Law's final, you know, goal. Though the kind of, it's weird how like Dressrosa, all of that was kind of like just like a step on the journey. Like, we're going to take out Kaido, but we have to take out Doflamingo first. So like, this was just, you know, a side plot in a way before the main goal of Kaido. And I know that's, you know, eventually what like the Wano arc is about, I believe. But yeah, so Kaido, I knew that he was big, but I didn't know he was that big. So like, oh, I guess he's like giant size. And I know sizes in One Piece are what all over the place, but I didn't expect him to be like I don't know what the word is, but you know, a type of person who's like, he's got a death wish. He just wants to kill himself. Like, oh, okay, I guess that's his thing. I did not know that. How is he an emperor? So, oh, I just looked at that scene again with this mysterious girl. She's got like a animal nose. So, yeah, what am I supposed to see?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought I remembered something about her mouth, but I guess it's more like a snout of some sort.
She has like her hands too. Like, she doesn't have like human hooves. Fingers. Yeah. Anyway, you know, find out more later. But yeah, the whole big, I can't do it justice, but the narrator comes in at this last part, talks a lot about Kaido. Kaido is the world's strongest man. He has tried to kill himself a bunch of times and he can't do it. He's been tortured and he's been in all these battles, and it's just like nothing can kill him. He's just unkillable. He's the strongest being and he just cannot die. And and he, of course, is one of the four emperors of the world. And we do hear a little bit about him at the end of this episode when he talks and he says something to the effect of he wants to make the world's final war, to tear down the world. And he's yelling for Joker. Yep. Like, come on, Joker, let's go. We got to finish this. Obviously, I'm being very careful what I say here. I can't. This is all this Oda stuff where it's like, remember this for the future. Yeah. Pretty much everything here in this whole episode, with the exception of the beginning at Kiros's place, everything else was, look at what you're going to learn more about in the near future, in the not so near future.
I have a couple of comments. These are not necessarily like lore stuff. The lore stuff is really great, and I'm going to try to remember this for hundreds of episodes down the line. But one, there was a scene of Kuros where you didn't see his whole body, but he looked like he was walking like normally. Like, is he supposed to be missing a leg? But
well, every whenever he would walk as the toy soldier, he did the same thing where like, It there's no physics that makes sense when he walks.
Like, he moves a leg, even though he's missing half a leg. It's still
he's missing a leg, like, and he still walks like a person with two legs. It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a scene early on in this episode, and it was probably just an animation thing. Like, it looks fine if it's a still panel and he's just sort of just moving, and you can assume that he's hopping or wobbling or whatever. But yeah, there was a scene early in the episode where he's just like walking on the hill or whatever. And it's not showing his legs, but it looks like he's just walking normally. Like, how does he do that? There was a scene. Some of the scenes with like the Nami, Sanji, Chopper crew that were pretty comedic, that are kind of fun. Like, there was a scene where Momonosuke and Brook were about to shield Nami from like the big water wave, and they're like, "We'll stop it." And they immediately, of course, since they're devil fruit users, get like paralyzed. And Nami is like, "You devil fruit users are pathetic." So that was fun.
Yeah,
like they forgot that they like will be immediately paralyzed by water. Also, like, I don't know why I didn't expect this, even though I like should have. Like, I feel like an idiot, but Sanji protects Nami from the dude, whatever his name was, Sheep's Head, and he's about to go in for his usual like embrace and get stopped, but then immediately he sees Ginrum and he's like, oh, like another girl, another woman, like I'm already infatuated with this girl who's attacking us. And she's like, ew, gross.
Yeah, she's just immediately like, oh god, get lost or something like that.
I don't know why I should have expected it, but Sanji immediately, even though they're being attacked, is already infatuated with this character.
Oh, and there was like a shot too, where like towards the end of that segment, where he walks up to Sheep's Head and kind of gets like a long look at his belt buckle, and you sort of see
symbol, emblem.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like a Jolly Roger look to it. You know what I mean? Like with a skull and everything. I want to say too that, like, even though obviously the animation in the first half of the episode was the typical, like, not so great Dressrosa stuff, I thought some of the stuff with, especially the part where Kaido was falling, and then like the reaction shots from all of the other supernovas watching him climb out of the thing, like that all looked really good to me. Like, I thought it was like, there's times when you can tell they've handed the scene off to a different animator, and suddenly like the line work is a lot sharper and it looks better. And especially the part where his like hand came out of the hole and it was like really smoothly animated. It's like, there are moments of like Sakuga in this episode that I thought looked pretty good.
No, I noticed that too.
Okay. So yeah, that was another interesting episode of One Piece of basically foreshadowing, but also story. I mean, we straight up are learning a little bit about what's going on elsewhere. Okay. Do we want to do any flavor alerts?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Even though it was just one episode, I do want to nominate Kerry Walgren as Seiko. I just thought, like, I was immediately sold on that personality and that performance, like, right away. And, like, this is great. Like, the way that they approach, like, I don't know what this character sounds like in Japanese, so I don't have that perspective about, like, how well does it emulate that. But just in English, it gave me a personality. And that performance kind of, and of course, what she was actually saying and doing in the episode, I just was like, yeah, this makes sense and it works out. And Carrie's great as a voice actress. So let's nominate her, even just on the one episode.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I thought the performance was great. I think the character's great. Like, I like this character. Is she's like cocksure and funny. I thought it was there was a funny moment when, because I was thinking it the whole episode, where I think Okarun is like, she doesn't even look that old.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, she doesn't. I mean, I know she's got white hair, but like, she just looks like she's in her like 40s to me. You know what I mean? Like, she doesn't look old. It's maybe 30s or something. And it's like, and she acts that way too. She's just, I don't know. She doesn't come off like an old lady to me. And I don't know. I just like her. I like her character so far. She's fun.
The way that Momo described Seiko in the very brief glimpses of her, of the grandma that we got in episode one, I think was sort of a, you know, kind of a nice like misdirection about like what we, you kind of expect the kind of typical, you know, maybe soft spoken, grandma, you know, wise type character, right? And like, no, not quite. Not really. So,
and to be fair, she is wise. She's just not stereotype wise. She's like, she's got like, she's got the knowledge, but she delivers it in like a sarcastic and like derogatory way that's just like demeaning sometimes the way she speaks to people. She's very blunt to a fault and very like honest to a fault. And even like, and also, but nice also where she's like teasing Momo about like, oh, you got a boyfriend, you know? She's like, he's not my boyfriend.
She kind of says the obvious thing where Momo says something where it's like, basically what would Ken Takakura do? And Grandma Seiko is like, well, he said his name was Ken, so you are in love with him. No, that's not what he meant. So
yeah, it's fun. That's a good one.
How about also, I've seen enough. Let's just nominate Stephanie Nadolny as Goku.
Yeah.
I've seen enough to put that nomination in.
Yeah. How do you spell her last name?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah. Without even thinking about it, I mentioned it earlier. I was just like, wow, I kind of really like her voice. It's just really good.
It's Nadolny.
She is the voice of Goku, Kid Goku.
Yeah, just see more like she's obviously kind of Goku's always had that mix of like, you know, battle shouts, but also primarily like obviously Goku's always been like a kid at heart, but now he's like a kid at heart and body, even though he's not a kid. And, you know, kind of that goofy, naive type of performance.
I've forgotten that he's grown up, honestly. Yeah. I mean, I don't that and to a point where maybe that's not. Yeah, well, also, I'm just kind of like thinking, like, am I maybe that's wasn't intended that I should forget that just because he just comes along like he just seems like a kid. And this is as much to do with the writing as it does with the performance. I think they're just like kind of just making Goku the kid Goku here. And it's like there's no knowledge there. I mean, he obviously has the skills that he had when he was a Z fighter. But I think his mannerisms don't belie any kind of wisdom from the future. It's just he's just a kid.
I get what you're saying. I do think it's partially intentional. Like even like a few episodes ago, Goku kind of casually says like, yeah, I got a wife and child at home. And I think Panzi at that point was like, what? No way. You're not an adult. So
I think it's the voice though, like that Stephanie does. That's just, I can't describe it, but it's just this weird way that he sounds that is really nice. Like it kind of harkens back to an older age of voice acting. But at the same time, it doesn't sound cringe at all. It sounds just different. And I like the sound of it. I don't know. I can't really describe it. It's just like, it's kind of a crunchy kid sound when she does his voice. It's just neat. I like it.
All right. Anything else?
I'm looking here.
Yeah, like nothing in Bleach, really. Do we have best fight? Rin versus... Impure King.
No, I'm not even going to give it even a nomination.
No, we did Yukio versus Toto, which was the better fight.
Yeah, Rin versus Impure King is.
Yeah,
it's just like that whole part of this episode too. It was just like me waiting for it to end. Like I'm just like I get it.
It was like a foregone conclusion. You just had to wait for it. So
right, he's going to use his flames. We get it. Impure King is going to roar.
There was no mystery or tension about like what's going to happen, what's the outcome of this going to be.
So. The only thing that gave me tension in this episode was when at the very beginning when the like barrier went down. And I thought, "Oh man, things are going to go crazy." And they didn't. Everyone reacted to the barrier going down, but it going down ultimately didn't matter. I can't think of anything else. I'm looking at the other categories.
We want to do best fight.
Oh, Tamagami, you think?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Might as well go put it in there. Why not?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It was pretty good. I mean, I thought it was entertaining.
Yeah.
I wonder if the other ones will be better, though.
I mean, they kind of have to scale up, right? So.
Right.
But it was fun. It had a good, like we talked about, it had a, especially the start of the fight, had a little bit more of that, like, you know, martial arts choreography, and not just, you know, power up beam stuff. So I feel like we need more worst characters. Who are some bad characters?
Hmm.
I don't know.
Hmm.
Impure King. He doesn't even count. He's not a character.
He's not even a, I mean, that's usually a good worst character to have when a character has no character, but this isn't even like a person.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't qualify because it isn't even a person. It's just more like just a blob.
It's like, it's just some sort of malevolent force. That's kind of boring.
Yeah. So. Very boring.
I forgot that we already put Impure King, AKA Blob Monster, as biggest disappointment.
Yeah, it's more of a disappointment.
In the character category.
Yeah, it makes more sense there.
If you were to rewatch this season where they're talking about the Impure King, like in the early episodes, it's like some long sealed away force. In retrospect, it's like, this is a blob monster. Dangerous, sure, but not very imposing.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot, I think, of best characters to add when we get closer to the end of the year, because we're kind of like sitting on some now, I think.
Yeah, we're definitely sitting on some for Dan.
Yeah.
Okay, we're at the end of we don't have any. I think the answer to this is no. But we practically have finished one season of Blue Exorcist. We're going into another one. Are any Blue Exorcist characters best character, male or female? I don't think so.
No. I mean, I would say, like I
think
said,
anyone really stood out.
I think Yukio has had the most character growth, but he's still the same character and not a particularly like amazing character. He's just okay. I think Bon has had some growth too, but again, not enough to where I feel like he's like some amazing character. He's just gotten growth.
Yeah.
I did think of something. I would like to nominate, what do you think about Seiko as a character design?
Oh.
Is it worthy or not?
Okay. I think so. Kind of like grandma with a tank top and a jacket and a baseball bat.
Well, she's like a cool grandma. She's like a grandma. I think her most pronounced feature is her hair, which stands up really tall. She's got that crazy white hair that stands up like kind of like Marge Simpson almost. But then she got these like glasses on and she wears cool clothes. I don't know. Seems very, she seems very youthful. Yeah. Anything else?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Well, let's wrap it up. That will do it for episode 436. Thank you for being here, Seda.
Yep.
And thanks again, Crocodile, for being here. And let us know in the thread if you guys are enjoying this new format. We did get one comment I saw of somebody who was like, they like the longer format. But I think it's us about trying to balance our time here, about spending too much time recording. But just letting you know. But I kind of like this getting through the shows quicker so that we have more time to talk about our feelings rather than just going over what happened. So anyway, we will be back next week for the season finale of Blue Exorcist, which we, of course, the show's not going anywhere. And other than that, the rest of the block will stay the same. And then until then, later.